Whoa, it's Bosco, an electro spit on rebel radio. Rebel radio, yeah. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I talk to the Rebels who are shaping youth culture. We talk about how they do it, why they do it, and what you can do to get a little piece of the pie for yourself. We're also the only show to bring you new music every week from our friends at EDM.com. Check it out. We are kicking off our fourth year of Rebel Radio. I appreciate all you that have been with us from the beginning. Everybody that's joined us recently, I hope you tune in and go back in the archives and check out some of our old episodes. I'm your host, Josh Levine. My guest this week is my man, Bosco. He is an old friend of mine. He was one of my early management clients. If you know me and we've talked about the music business at all, I made my first record deal with Bosco. We're going to talk about that in the interview. He's a great producer. You've probably heard a lot of his music with E40. If you're an E40 fan, you might have heard him on some Kanye records. This kid is dope. We get into a lot about our history together, the years that we worked together. We talk about hip hop and the music business in the 90s and lessons that we both learned along the way. Namely, how to combat perfectionism. We get into the value of open communication and just how hard that is to do, especially when you're young. There's some great stories here. This is the first of a two-parter. We're gonna come back next week and talk to Bosco about what he's up to now, but this one is really about the past and his journey to getting to this point. Some great stuff coming up on Rebel Radio right after our EDM.com track of the week. That was the EDM.com track of the week. Fievel was Stay In Tonight. If you like that one, get over to EDM.com, check out more new music. And now let's get into the interview with Bosco.
California love.
That's amazing.
This is electro spit. No. ESX1.
Okay.
And I'm playing it with the app right now.
And I mean, for people listening, this is all through a phone.
Yeah, this is using a phone, but not just a phone app. The sound is coming out of the phone and going into the ESX1 electro spit mobile talk box, which is the world's first mobile talk box and the world's incredible, most expressive instrument. So,
So that thing is hitting your vocal cords?
Exactly. So it's basically replacing the sound of my voice. So I don't have to talk or sing or anything. I just open my mouth, hit the key on the phone or keyboard or guitar, and then the sound just comes out of my mouth, and I just control it with my mouth.
But you're not actually singing.
I'm not saying anything.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's crazy.
Josh Levine.
That's wild.
Electro spin. Hey, rebel.
Yeah, so
cool.
That's what we're doing right now.
That's incredible. So yeah, I want to learn how that came about. I know you've
we've got a lot of backstory for years. Yes.
But this is an amazing innovation.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's learn about where that came from, and
how do we know each other?
I was trying to remember how we met. I know how we met.
Okay.
So I was managing Skin Deep.
Okay.
Which was a girl group that was too early and a less talented Spice Girls. Steve-O at EMI Publishing was one of the few dudes who, like, I was an intern.
Yeah.
You know, just starting in the music business. And he was, like, one of the dudes that would pay attention to me, take meetings with me. I'd come in, bring him stuff, whatever. I'm pretty sure Steve-O connected me with you.
Really?
Yeah.
I do remember getting now a tape.
Yep.
I feel like you have made some like demo tapes or whatever of Skin Deep. And that's crazy. We were with Steve-O this morning.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. I haven't seen that dude in years, but I have a lot of love for him, because like I said, you know, you're starting out and like no one has any reason to take your call, but there's just a few people that I remember were really generous with their time, and he was one. So yeah, I was managing this girl group. We got a demo deal with Randy Jackson at Columbia.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And we needed to go make a demo, so he connected me with you, and we made Do You Want to Get Funky? And we did not get signed.
Well, you know, it was early.
It was all right. I mean, that was a great experience for me. It was my first time really ever in the studio, you know, trying to make a record. I had no idea how records were made. They had no reason to let me lead that process, but right. They did.
Hey, sometimes you got to use trial and error.
No, it worked out great. And then, you know, I got to meet you through that. There's a third producer who I can't remember. I'm sure he was great. And then the other one was Red Foo.
Mm-hmm.
Who at the time was he was called Kendall Gordy, and he had produced Ahmad.
Really?
But he went on to be Red Foo of LMFAO.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So he did a couple songs. Yeah. So that was 91.
Okay. And 91. What else was happening in 91? Ooh, I was a sophomore at USC.
Yeah.
And I had my whole production set up in my bedroom. I mean, my dorm room or whatever, I think. Had I moved to the house?
Yeah, when I met you, you were living in the house.
I'm going to tell you something about my memory.
Okay.
My memory is like, it's an assisted memory. It works if it gets a little job.
Okay.
So I'm gonna use you to
assist. That's good. Yeah. So no, I remember coming to the house, and it was like a frat house.
Yeah. Man, all these memories are coming back now that you mention it. Yeah. Like the earthquake, like being in that house.
Yeah.
When the Northridge quake happened.
Yep.
All my equipment like fell over. I thought somebody was coming to steal all my gear. And that place was like, it was like put together with putty and like Elmer's glue. Like that whole house was barely standing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But
Okay, and then it goes from there. But I want to go back.
Yeah.
First.
Okay.
Because we, you know. You're one of those people that gave me opportunities that I wasn't ready for, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we'll talk about some of those, but I want to. So,
And neither was I.
Yeah, I mean, it took me a long time to realize that's part of the game.
Yeah.
But so let's go back to how it got started. Do you remember the first record that you ever bought?
Ooh. I can't say for sure that this was the first one, but it might have been like Roxanne.
Okay.
I think it was the real Roxanne. And then I went back and bought like UTFO, uh-huh. which Roxanne, the real Roxanne, it's Roxanne Shanté, not the real Roxanne.
Right.
Roxanne Shanté was like the answer to UTFO, but I brought Roxanne Shanté first. Yeah.
Well, my name is Roxanne, I don't you know, I just a cold rocker party and I do this show. I said I met these three guys and you know it's true. Now let me tell you and explain them all to you. I met this dude with the name of a hat. I didn't even walk away, I didn't give him no rap. But then he got real mad and he got a little tired. If he worked for me, you know he would be tired.
I had, that's probably one of the first records I got. And I had won this set of turntables in the breakdancing contest.
So, wait, at what age?
Ooh, this was like seventh grade or something like that. Yeah, sixth, seventh grade. And so I went down to Stereo Superstore and got the new turntable. It was a piece of junk. You had to set the quarter.
Belt drive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Belt drive. No, it was direct drive. Oh,
okay.
It was direct drive turntable, but it had a built-in tape deck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
all that shit seemed like a good idea. I had the JVC with the built-in turntable.
Oh, that's see.
That like was you pulled
the one that slid out or
linear tracking turntable. Oh. Yeah, it slid out from the front.
That was baller back then.
I love that thing.
Uh-huh. So when you're scratching, especially with those kind of turntables, you don't want the needle to jump. So what you had to do was you had to set a quarter.
Right.
Or, you know, a stack of pennies on your needle so it wouldn't move.
Yeah.
And that way you could get down.
Then that fucks up your record.
Then it wears a hole in your record. So I'm Shanté. That part, you probably couldn't even hear that on my record because I had scratched it so much.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's it. That was the one.
Okay. And then when did you start making music? I know you played basketball growing up.
Yeah, you know, we're all breakdancing and we just loved the music. And then when I got the turntable, I got a little mic, and then we would start freestyling over records in the basement. And then I started DJing little house parties, and I used the money to buy a 4-track. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I've always been like into gadgets and technology. So I just kept buying more. So I got the 4-track and I got a Atari ST computer, and I started sequencing, and I got different, like I got a little five. The first time I got a drum machine, I rented a 505 drum machine for like a couple days, and I loved it.
Yeah.
Then I think I bought a DX drum machine, and I started making beats with that. And so that was middle school, making tapes with the homies in the basement.
So, and that's in Portland.
Yeah, Portland, Oregon.
So it's funny because the first time I ever went to Portland was with you for the Pohop.
Oh yeah, festival. Portland. Yeah.
And
cool nuts.
You know, I was amazed just seeing the culture there and how, you know, so that would have been 95, probably 94.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing like you know, so we were obviously just hanging out with your friend, you know, with rappers, and like hip hop community, and then at the Pohop shows, it was a very mixed crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking, like, that's interesting. There's a bunch of white kids and like looking grunge, but they're really excited to see Kenny Mac.
Yeah, like, right.
You know,
hardcore hip hop,
and you know that which was kind of like a San Francisco thing too, where there's just this just a very diverse flow. And then, but now, you know, now that I've been to Portland more recently, there's definitely this narrative that like there's no black people in Portland.
Yeah.
And which was not what I had experienced.
Right.
But so I'm curious about like what was the hip hop community like when you were growing up?
Man, you know, It's funny, I didn't think of a concept like hip hop community at that time.
Cause, yeah, of course.
I was like, what are you, 12, 11?
Yeah, you're not thinking about that. Of course.
But at that age, I had already started DJing parties.
Right.
We would, you know, one thing that was crazy, I would go all through the city, and I don't even know how my mom allowed it, but I would go to house parties, like all around our neighborhood until late hours at the night. I would be DJing, we would be breakdancing, pop, people would have battles at the different parties or whatever, and just the hip, it was so exciting. Like, you get on your bike, you ride to this house party, you hook up with some friends, you go into the basement, there's a DJ spinning, or I'm the DJ that's spinning, and it was just so much fun. There's all these different crews, and certain people would get a name, like, I'm trying to think of this cat named Polly Paul was one of the dopest, like, producers, and he was the one that, he was like the guy that kind of inspired me to take my production maybe to another level. Cause I went into his, he invited me over. He had this group was called the Dynamic Sound Machine. It's him and this guy named Roni. And they were way ahead in terms of technology. Mm. Like he had the DMX drum machine. He had a Pro One synthesizer. Before anybody that I knew had one of those, and he was making, you know, dope beats.
But you know what's interesting about the hip hop culture of that time in Portland is a lot of those people that you came up with, they still are in hip hop today, like Pete Miser.
Yeah. Looking at me in the mirror, saying, "Damn, homie, you so fine. Right. Who's that dude? Everybody wanna be, you wanna be next to." First, then before I spit the verse, off the top, rock the spot like the shit's rehearsed. Reverse Cobra clutch with more heat than a soldier touch. Bitter as fuck, cause my records ain't sold enough. Old enough to know better than to get upset. Still rapping, I guess I'm not fed up yet.
My first hip hop group that I, when I was making tapes in the basement, the first group that I started was called the Real to Real Production Crew.
Okay.
It was this guy, Solomon David, David Calamifoni, and Marlon Irving. And now Marlon Irving and Solomon David are now the Lifesavers.
Oh, okay.
Who are and part of Black Alicious. And
who goes by Jumbo Man?
Yeah, Solomon goes by Jumbo, but that we started way back then, and unfortunately, my man David Calamifoni, who was in the group, got shot like not long after, so there was a lot of gang violence.
Yeah,
growing up in Portland.
Sure,
but man, just the hip hop scene was vibrant, man.
That's cool.
And it was funny because Cool Nuts was like, he wasn't in the group, but he was like one of my best friends. He was always there.
Right.
He's like, "Man, I got skills too, man. I can get down." So he would be writing, and he's like, "Man, make some beats for me, Bosco." At the time, my name wasn't, I went by the Cool Genius.
Okay.
Also, sometimes Billy I went Beat? Billy Beat. I went by Billy Beat. Now, right. Now everybody puts Beat after their name, so I might need to go back to Billy Beat. I got a hat somewhere that says that, but I had the starter jacket with the Floor Rockers, which was my breakdancing crew on the back. It was all yellow. It was just a fun time, man. I used to breakdance the Floor Rockers crew. We broke dance for the Blazers at halftime. We were sponsored by Nike.
Wow.
Like, we just had it going on way back in the day. Just amazing. Music everywhere, man. And then when the movie Breaking came out, and Beat Street came out, I can't think of the guy's name, but he was head spinning on the cover of Newsweek or Time or whatever. It's like you just knew, man, this music is taking over the world, man, and sure. I'm part of this movement.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
So at what point did you realize that this was going to be your career?
when I got a large check from this company called Fox Television for this theme song to In Living Color, you know, my mom's civil, she's a math professor, civil engineer. Mm-hmm. My grandmother's a math professor, also engineer. And my family was, but everybody played an instrument. So music was very important in our family, but it was not seen as a career choice. And it was all just fun and passion. But in Portland, there's no music industry.
Right.
I didn't know that there was a such thing as a career, really, in as a music producer, mm-hmm. much less like an executive. Or I just, you know, I'm going to be an engineer and I love music.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I could make a record someday, but it wasn't like a career choice. But when, and I had actually, before Living Color, I got... So when I went to USC, I got a full ride scholarship, academic scholarship, and I could have went to, I also got an opportunity to go to Stanford. I got accepted to Stanford, USC, and Portland State, and University of Oregon. But I decided to go to USC because I knew the music industry was in Los Angeles.
Okay.
That was definitely a strategic decision, but also they had an aerospace engineering and I might have wanted to be a rocket scientist.
Wow.
So, anyway, and they had a really dope recording engineering program at USC.
Okay.
So all of those things made USC attractive, but especially the music industry being there. But when I was there on the basketball team, I met this dude named Tremaine Ankrum. I didn't get a basketball scholarship. I walked on the team.
Mm-hmm.
And Tremaine introduced me to...
Did you play?
Yeah, yeah, I played. I mean, I didn't start. Harold Miner started, but I did, you know, I did play.
Yeah, yeah.
So he introduced me to this girl named Leah Reese, who was also another engineering student at USC who played keyboard, and her boyfriend was this guy named... they called him Moto.
Mm-hmm.
And... So we like hooked up and made some beats together and said, oh, let's form a production team or whatever. And came up with the name Mad Dookie Productions. Because it was mad.
I remember that.
We had all the mad shit.
If you're enjoying this one, let's go back into Rebel Radio archives. Check out my interview early on with AMG. You might know him from Bitch Better Have My Money. He and Bosco go way back, and I forget, one of them introduced me to the other. I don't remember how it all happened, but go back and check out that interview. It was a great talk right at the beginning of Rebel Radio. And of course, let's finish up now with Bosco.
So then, Tremaine also had a friend from Denver, this guy named John, Big John, who was a DJ. And he said, man, you got to send your production tape to my boy, Big John, man. Let him hear it, man. And so we sent him the tape. He got excited about the music. Said, man, I want to come down and work with you, man. I want to manage you. So he came out to L.A., met with us, started shopping our tape around. It didn't happen overnight, but... he was able to get us a publishing deal at EMI, which was great because we got enough money to buy some equipment and made it a little more real that we could maybe do this for a living as opposed to just being a hobby. But being part of that production team, Moto's best friend was AMG.
Okay.
Who was down with DJ Quick and had... single Bitch Better Have My Money, and so we would hang out. Moto would take us out with AMG, and we go over Quick's house, and so that I started meeting people in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
We met this cat Volume 10 at the who was rapping at the Good Life, and Moto was like, man, this is the next dude. We need to work with him. So we started doing demos with him. And he ended up getting a deal off of the demos that Moto and I and Leia and put together.
Mm-hmm.
and with Adrian Miller over at Immortal Records, and that was, and then we got the B-side of the first single. The first single was Pistol Grip Pump, and it's funny, we did Where's the Sniper? I think that was the B-side, matter of fact.
Yeah, I think so.
And the song called Knock Out Your Skull, Styles on Deck, like four songs on his album, but that was our first like placement that we got.
Yeah.
Fast forward a little bit. One of the people that I had met was this guy, DJ Trey Ski, who was he used to be on K-Day. He won one of the world mixing championship. Like, he a really dope DJ.
Okay.
And he's also produced, but he did everything he did was sample based. And he had got the gig to be the DJ on In Living Color, but his productions. Okay, so then they needed a new theme song for In Living Color.
Yeah.
And all of his productions were sample based, so they couldn't use anything of his. And he and I had just had struck up a friendship and were working on different production stuff. And he's like, hey, why don't you help me with this Living Color thing? And I was like, okay, sounds good to me. So we put it together, collaborated, made something original. He cut. When I say he cut, he scratched on it. You know, we really collaborated on it. Put this big laugh at the beginning, like, okay, just me belly laughing. Submitted it, crossed fingers, toes, ankles. Please, can they take this?
Right.
They selected. We got now, I'm a junior in college with a theme song to a hit television show. My Amazing. First big placement. And then not only did we do the theme song, we did the Fly Girls used to dance, like Jay. We had J-Lo and all the Fly Girls. We did, they called them dance bumpers. So all the original music that you hear in this 93-94 season was created by me and DJ Trey Ski. And some nice checks for a college kid.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, that was like a launch pad for my whole career for sure.
Yeah.
You know, one of many launch pads, but it was definitely a key point.
Thinking back to that first group, Matt Dookie.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounded like that wasn't your first group, but.
no.
But, you know, obviously, as you said, at that age, you don't have the maturity. You know,
definitely.
But when you think back about that, what did you learn from the experience of having partners and you know, what have you carried into the rest of your life?
I don't think that I learned the lesson that I needed to learn at that time. It it was very depressing. Like, I felt personally betrayed that, because the problem in the group was that I had a set of equipment and Mo and Leia shared a set of equipment. And then they had, like any couple, they had their own dynamics, you know,
of course,
being, you know, happy at one time. And sometimes they weren't always getting along. Yeah. I mean, overall, they got along great. But so I felt that the way we were splitting everything wasn't fair. And now looking back at it, we could have figured out some kind of incentive based, you know, if you make this many tracks and these get placed and you worked on this one, you get a, we could have easily figured out a way to split it up. So when I came to them with that, idea, I think they took it as an attack, like, oh, Bosco thinks he's better than us or whatever. And so then they wanted to break up.
Yeah.
Break the code. And I never wanted that, that wasn't my intention. I just said, let's
like,
work.
Wait a second.
Yeah, let's work out a new way to do our business or whatever. Yeah. Not let's just break up. And I felt like now my friends hate me and so I was very depressed for a long time about that whole situation. So I guess I didn't necessarily, I would say part of the legacy of that is I didn't do another, I'm very wary of doing partnerships
sure.
and groups after that experience.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the groups that I had been in had fallen apart. And
all right, our next story is not going to help that. I already know where this is going. It's not good. Yeah.
So, and you know, I guess I'm still learning that.
Sure. So,
it's a real surreal production crew broke up too. So.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So no, as we said, we met, you know, over Skin Deep, and then, you know, kind of hit it off, but I don't think we even really like spent too much time talking to each other.
Not right off the bat.
And then it was, you know, some months later, I don't know how much later, would have been a year or two. Either you called me or I called you. I have no idea why.
Yeah.
And you had this group Three Ways.
Yeah. Trey, W-A-Y, motherfucking Z.
That, and you had some interest from a label. From what's his name? Dave at Atlantic, at Big Beat.
Right.
Forget Dave's last name. Shout out to Dave, whoever you are.
Dave, it'll come to us in a second.
Right, and you needed, and you had a lawyer, and you needed a manager.
Right.
And so I became the manager for the group, except it was really you. Like, I didn't really barely knew these other guys.
Yeah. Yeah, so I will say that one of the lessons that I had learned from the Mad Dookie situation is I wanted to be more in control of the partnerships. If it was warranted, and in this situation with the group Three Ways, it was because I was doing all the production, I had the most experience,
right?
Had all the equipment, I was investing all the money, I had the business savvy.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely felt like it was your group.
Yeah.
And so, and I was, you know, at the time, I kind of wanted to be a manager.
Mm-hmm.
I was working at Herb Magazine.
Right.
Throwing Herb parties, Magazine. Writing, you know, for The Source and a bunch of other people.
Yeah.
I had managed, the first kid I managed was a guy I went to college with, and we made no money together or didn't even get close to any money.
Yeah, didn't see any money.
But he introduced me to Skin Deep. Oh, that was the other producer. It was Roy Campanella.
Okay.
Who's another guy that kind of took a chance on me. It didn't really benefit him or me directly. But we're still good friends.
Yeah.
And anyway, so...
I think the lesson is you don't know what the fuck you're doing at that age.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's something to that. And like... just that knowledge, right, and accepting that fact. And I always tell people, like, that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't do whatever you're about to do.
No.
But just know that you're going into something that you don't really understand, right? So go into it with that.
Right.
With that learning.
Right.
As your objective.
Right.
And so it took me years, too, to figure that out.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, if I knew how hard certain things were going to be, I never would have even tried. So there's some value to that ignorance.
Yeah.
But you could certainly go into it and say, hey, I'm going to go learn through this experience and pay more attention to those things.
Right.
And I think, you know, part of it was that that energy that you mentioned earlier of this, like, that we're gonna take over the world. We're going to change the world.
Yeah.
We saw it happening.
Yep.
Like Yeah, hip hop and especially that community in LA where, you know, guys like Paul Stewart were becoming, who were like, Paul Stewart wasn't really a peer because he was a step or two ahead of us, but he was definitely like, you could see him out at night, you could get him on the phone. He was, you know, he felt relatable.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, this dude was, you know, making superstars and working with superstars, you know, all over the world and all that stuff. So, you know, I think there was definitely, as I look back, like, I definitely had a false, unearned sense of confidence that was fueled by just the energy around me.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Like you said, you wouldn't have attempted it otherwise.
Right. Absolutely. So you gave me that opportunity to manage the group, and you know, quickly we got into a bidding war.
Yeah, the group was a rapper named Semi and Evandre Jones. So it was, his name was Crisis. Well, at the time, no, he was Shiesty.
Shiesty.
We called him Shiesty at the time. And he was a 7-foot basketball prodigy, McDonald's All-American, who USC introduced me to him because they were recruiting him to go to USC.
Oh, wow.
And the reason that he came to USC is mostly because he wanted to work with me
on beats
and on music. Mm-hmm. Nowhere else could he have gotten that opportunity.
Nice.
So,
but he didn't want to do basketball.
But he didn't really want to play basketball. He was good.
Obviously.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't just tall. He was tall and skilled, but it just, his heart was in music. And but we started making that summer, I think, during his freshman year, or after, we started making tapes and created three-way stuff, and it was coming out like dope, like man, great records. And then we got with Josh.
So this is 94. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, The Chronic and Doggy Style and all that was just, you know, couldn't have been any bigger.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, labels were just looking for what's next. Yeah. Right. And, you know, especially, you know, most of the big hip hop labels were from New York. And they focused on New York music, and they saw this thing happening out west that they weren't part of, and they wanted to be part of it. So it was a perfect, I mean, the music was great. The group was really interesting. You had this 7-footer who people thought was the next Snoop. You had a little scrappy white dude.
Yeah.
You know, and it was great. And you know, the demo was amazing. So we had really quickly, we had interest from Atlantic, Def Jam, Tommy Boy, Jive, Ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
And then MCA.
And Quincy Jones.
Yeah, Quest.
Like Quest.
And we start getting offers, and the money started getting bigger and bigger. And, you know, Bosco's calling me. I remember, I can picture in my head walking out of the Bally's on Ventura Boulevard, because, you know, you had called me like, we got to take a deal. Like, we got these offers on the table. Why are we not signing a deal? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, let's, I remember that by the end of the conversation, we're like, well, let's set a deadline. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause I was kind of like, well, so-and-so Tommy Boy said they're going to make an offer. They haven't come back yet. Right. Do we really want to not
hear
what they have to say? Right. And Bosco was like, yeah, but these people are going to lose interest. They're going to move on, sign something else, whatever. And I think, you know, that was a good lesson. Because there wasn't one right answer. Mm-hmm. You could certainly wait too long. You could certainly move too fast.
Yeah.
You have to read, you know, the mood, the energy of the deal. And I didn't know how to do that. Neither one of us had the experience Mm-mm. yet. So, but at that time, I remember feeling like some urgency to like, okay, my client like wants to get this done. Like, okay, I got to. Because before that call, I had just been thinking like, oh, we're going to string them out. Let's get as much money as we can,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, part of that is the money, and part of it is the priority that that makes you within the company, right? If they spend a lot of money on you, mm-hmm. they want to pay attention to you.
Right.
So I feel like we're getting close. All really good choices, and for the most part, right? And we had, you know, I was telling somebody yesterday, we went and spent 2 hours in the Four Seasons with Russell Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that to me was like, that's one of those moments you'll never forget, right? Because you're 23 years old.
Yep, Russell.
And this dude is paying attention to you.
Yeah. He's like, you need to sign with Def Jam.
And that was to Dante Ross's label,
mm-hmm.
right? So we had all these really good options. My boy Terry was at Ruthless. He wanted to start his own label.
Right.
And Jerry Heller was gonna support him in that.
And we were wary of signing to Ruthless Records with the reputation that they had, and Jerry Heller.
Yeah, and a lot of that we didn't know.
We didn't know.
I mean, there was all this rumor.
Yeah.
Right? And we didn't have the internet. We didn't have Ice Cube to make movies for us.
Right. Tell us what happened.
To tell us what's what, right? So I remember that call, too, with the lawyer who was yelling on the phone that he was going to increase his fee by $50,000 to pay for his personal security. If we were going to do a deal with Ruthless. And so I was like, well, why don't we just go see what they have to say? You know, I didn't understand. I think now, I probably still would have met with them. I still, you know, respect Jerry and what he did. And I didn't have the fear that this guy had of going to sit with, so quote unquote, gangsters, although Jerry Heller was definitely not a gangster. But I actually didn't know that.
Right.
I still wasn't scared, but I just thought, like, let's entertain the conversation.
Yeah.
So the deal was I had to go by myself without any of the artists. So I show up at Jerry's house. Terry's like, where the fuck is everybody?
They're on the way.
They can't make it, whatever.
you got his cold.
So I got this beautiful tour of Jerry's house, and his wife served us lunch.
Oh, that's cool.
And then we get a meeting at RCA, MCA,
mm-hmm.
with the president and a label. And there's a reason I'm telling the story, but a label called Gasoline Alley.
Fucking Gasoline Alley.
So so we go in there. We already had great offers. We were more or less ready. It was not quite a formality, but we were just like, let's just go see what else is out there. So we walk in and I knew for a fact we weren't doing a deal with these people because the label was garbage.
Yeah. They had no idea about, it was a pop.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were probably doing country music or something.
It was a pop label.
They had no idea of anything about rap music.
They had that one song, Hell of a. That was,
Hell of a.
Yeah, yeah. That was like a bad pop rap, you know. Yeah. But they had a tiny hit with that. And the dude's nephew was trying to start his career and mm-hmm. wanted to use us for that. So we go and take the meeting, and I remember being arrogant. And I remember saying to them, like, hey, there's no way we could sign with you guys. You don't know this. And I said, I'm sure I must have come across really arrogant in that meeting. I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And I probably could have, you know, approached that more respectfully, but I was hanging out with people like Dante Ross and looking up to their style of confrontation and all of that.
She just got out of a meeting with Russell Simmons, man.
Yeah, so I'm like, now you people.
We're in demand.
So
Quincy Jones is trying to get at us.
So we leave that meeting and try to go about our business. And then basically what happened, right, is that they got at a couple of the dudes in the group.
Yeah, so the connection was that Lebo, one of the members of the group, I don't remember if he was related or his cousin or something.
Might have been his cousin.
Was related to the guy who ran Gasoline Alley, or related to him directly, Randy Phillips.
Yeah, so, Randy Phillips, who's now the CEO of what used to be SFX, a huge festival promoter.
Right.
He's done okay.
Yeah, I'm sure he was already doing okay.
He was managing Share at the time. Like, dude had money.
Yeah. He was big time. He was big time. We didn't want to sign with him because they didn't know the music.
Yeah.
But it wasn't because they weren't successful.
Right.
But he contacted Lebo and basically was like, well, I can just sign you instead of. He figured out that he couldn't sign the group, and so he said, well, I'll do a deal with you, Lebo, and then I'll offer you so much money that the rest of the group will have to come along with you.
Right.
So we said, well, I said, let's not sign with them, but you know, he's offering him $200,000 or $300,000, and
which at the time was life changing.
So
mm-hmm.
But the result is now the group is breaking up.
Right.
We can't take any of these other deals because Lebo's going with Gasoline Alley.
So in the middle of the bidding war with, you know, the six
ten,
top
ten labels,
hip-hop labels.
Yeah.
We break the group breaks up.
Right. Yeah, it hurt.
101 right there.
We didn't have our game tight.
Basically. Definitely. It definitely hurt. And it took me some time to realize the mistakes that got us there.
What would you say? Like, what should we have done?
Well, I think, like, first of all, having paper between everybody.
Yeah.
Like, so if you wanted to have your production company, we should have had those guys signed to production company. We should have... You know, had me signed as the manager of the group where I had certain authority, right? Like, so, you know, that's the simplest thing. That may not have solved the issue anyway.
Contract getting broken all the time.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know,
yeah.
What I've learned about contracts is that the real value, I mean, there's the one value when everything falls apart and you, and that's all you have left is this paper.
Yeah.
But, usually you don't want it to come to that.
Right.
Right. And so the real value in contracts that I do now in my business is the conversation we have when we're building the contract together.
Yeah.
And we say, hey, we're going to put something down on paper that we both have to live with by law.
Right.
So why don't we make sure we really understand what we're each getting into?
Right.
And if there's any disagreements, we can handle that now. And then, right.
Yeah. That's definitely
that's the real value.
Yeah, having an understanding, clear understanding, and knowing what you're getting into, so there's no surprises, no miscommunication, or less
for sure
miscommunication.
What I learned at that moment though was different.
Yeah,
right. Was like
don't have meetings with fucking
no, Randy no. Phillips. Well, it wasn't. I mean, I didn't know how to solve that one. What I learned at that moment was really about thinking on your feet. Right, because I didn't want to lose that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, you were the group, so we flipped it, and it was a Bosco solo deal.
Right,
right, and then I had to go back and sell that to these labels.
Mm-hmm.
Why that was just as good, and we wanted the same money.
Right,
and you know, and it ended up working. Yep. Right, and that's not. I don't want you. You know. That's credit to you because, you know, you turned around in a few days. I don't know how long. Made a new demo.
Right. Yeah. So the group broke up. We knew we couldn't take any of the deals. So what's the solution? All right. Well, now it's a Bosco solo record. So we remade some of the records, made new records that like captured.
Passing Time, Bombay. Passing
Time, Bombay.
About a year ago, a homie of mine asked me to say some hell of a tight rhyme, so I said this rhyme I'm about to say. The motherfucker dealt it in the county bomb by hitting corners with my nigga rolls every day, seeing how many hoochies we can fit in the tray. You get me took down off the Alizé. We got the Bombay, the Bombay.
So basically I had to become the full NWA.
That's right.
Instead of just Dr. Dre.
That's right.
I had to be Nate Dogg. I had to be Snoop. I had to be Corrupt. And
But I think, you know, to use that analogy, like you were, I think you were the young Dr. Dre, right? And it was this, I think the labels that were still interested kind of got that there would be talent around you.
Right.
Right, that you'd end up building a stable and whatever. And so we got a deal done. We end up, you know, we still had multiple offers.
Yep.
And we still got a deal done. We end up signing a Big Beat Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Craig Kalman wrote us a very nice check.
One of the biggest checks, definitely the biggest I had seen at that time.
For sure.
And still, even to this day, a nice sizable check.
Yeah. That was amazing. And then I know we're kind of belaboring this, but it's interesting for me personally because there's so many lessons that came out of that experience.
Yeah.
The last big one being they didn't want the record that we ended up making.
Yeah.
And so we went and turned the record in and they were like, cool, this is a good demo. Now let's go fix it.
Yeah.
And we were like, nah, this is the record. Yeah. And so they let us out of the deal. I mean, it ended up, you know, in some ways working out nicely. got to keep the money and
It was good. I would say the deal, it was good from the money standpoint, but we never got to release the music.
No, of course.
And that's like a big regret for me. Like I would have
definitely
that music. I feel like it would have done well. You know, you never know, but
it's one of those things. I think what happened. I never talked to Craig about this, but I think he, like we, got swept up in the momentum of a bidding war, and he wanted to win.
Right.
And he, you know, either agreed to something that he wasn't really that interested in, or he wasn't really direct with us that, like, I'm going to guide you through making a record, and what you have here is good enough to get signed, but it's not good enough to get released.
Right.
And I think you probably wouldn't tell somebody that if you're in a competitive situation.
No.
Right. So I don't fault him either.
Yeah.
I think he was doing his job.
Right. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm guessing they probably have a very hands-on, like, creative process.
I mean, you were always a producer and an artist.
Yeah.
And then, you know, over time you became more just focused on production. Was there a conscious choice? I mean, I know you did some other things with DBA and.
Yeah, I think my personality is, I'm a perfectionist and you always want your stuff to be perfect. So, part of the downside of that is you don't release as much stuff. You don't finish as much stuff. And then I like to help other people get their thing together. So people ask me to work on their record, and I would always put other people's records ahead of mine. So I think I never stopped wanting to be an artist. I'm still, you know, want to be an artist.
Is that right?
Yeah. At least that's the story that I tell myself. And, but I don't finish a lot of records. Okay. I haven't finished a lot of records, you know, for myself.
Well, yeah, somebody else gives you a deadline.
Yeah, right? That's what it is.
You know, and I remember the times in the studio with, you know, Spice One.
Yeah.
And, you know, E-40.
Yeah.
I remember who else was in that house.
There's a song called Money Schemes that I did for E-40 with JL Felony.
Uh-huh.
And 40 calls me, like, in the afternoon, hey, I got JL Felony with me. You got any heat over there? We on our way.
Right.
No, I didn't have anything at all for them. And so I start making a beat.
Right.
And they're there like 30 minutes or an hour later. I got a bass line.
Wow.
JL Felony's in the booth rapping to the beat.
Right.
And 40's on the couch writing his lyrics. And we got Money Schemes. Boom.
It's caught right on sight of taking flight. It's the rain on your head. I'm turning the roof off this bitch tonight. As you fall like God, but try to slice my pie, nigga, die. While your bitch give up the ball,
my niggas having fantasy dreams.
Coming up, cause I'm y'all on the money scheme. All my niggas
having fantasy dreams. I would never approach one of my own songs and give myself an hour deadline to finish the record. And
maybe you should.
Maybe I should. You know.
Well, that's what I was gonna wonder. Like, is there a way to apply that to yourself?
It's called a record label and management. Uh-huh. but basically, yeah, I think it's very difficult to stand outside of yourself and coach. It's like coaching yourself.
Yeah.
So I needed a coach, and maybe I had too much control. Yeah. You know, I'm instead of somebody saying, Bosco, I need the record right now.
Right.
But you have. You want to perform at the... I want to make the greatest record of all time and at least the greatest record I've ever made. So it needs a certain amount of time that's going to be spent on it. But you don't take into account that you've been doing this your whole life and you can make something great today.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can make another thing that's great tomorrow. But the thing that you made yesterday or today can be selling while you're making the new thing.
I mean, that seems to be just in general...
Yeah, it doesn't have to be music.
Well, but for music specifically, I think there's been a shift, you know, generationally or you know, just the circumstance of where music is at right now, that there's a lot more people just making stuff today and releasing it.
I think it's the technology, you know, that we, the people have access to releasing stuff constantly. So instead, and people have realized that the story behind, like the behind the scenes, can be as valuable or more valuable than the final product.
Right.
And that's part of the product, and people are going to be more interested in the final product if they've seen it being created. Like, I know personally, whenever I am in the studio with someone and they create a record, I like it much better than if I just hear a demo, because I'm invested. I saw the product.
Yeah, of course.
I
spent time.
I saw the expression on the person's face when they were singing the lyrics or rapping the song or whatever. It's just a whole different experience. And using modern technology like social media, it's basically reality TV,
right?
Spread out over each Instagram post and each Facebook and each, you know, Snapchat or whatever.
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, I've talked to some, you know, artists who like they collab, mm-hmm. you know, they get features, whatever. Yeah. But they, you know, like in the old days, that meant everybody went into the studio together.
Right.
I was just watching that the Tupac movie.
Mm.
All Eyes on Me.
Yeah.
And there was that scene where he was in making California Love, mm-hmm. and then he walked out and he went into the other room.
Yeah.
And made whatever that song was with Daz. Shit, now I'm gonna forget what it was. But it was literally like they were all in the studio together and he went in to get on Snoop's record and then he went on to just get on the other record, you know.
That's how it happens, and that's how it's supposed to happen. And part of that is when you are paying for studio time.
Sure. So now you talk to a lot of artists about, you know, the features that they've had or the collabs, mm-hmm. and it's like, well, they never met each other.
Right.
Right. Somebody sent a track, somebody sent back the vocals, and you know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if we can hear it in the record or not. I'm not sure.
Yes, you definitely can, because I know, like, the records, some of the best records that I've made, it wasn't I made the beat and E-40 wrote the lyrics. Nah, I came up with a bass line and 40 heard me playing some sounds. He's like, ooh, that one, I like that one, put that in there. Mm-hmm. Well, what if you put some bells or something and make some shit go backwards? And then he's writing some lyrics, and I'm like, oh, that's tight. What if you make the story about, you know, going to Houston, and, you know, you could say, you know, whatever it is, it's a collaborative effort. And so there's no way that we can make that independently of each other.
Is he the person you've produced for the most?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. I've definitely done more songs with 40 than anybody else.
So what makes that a good partnership?
I think that the reason that it was successful was, one, I give him the credit. He's an amazing artist in terms of being prolific.
He's a genius.
Writing, you know, constantly making songs.
Yeah.
He was open to that creative process of, you know, getting in there and having input on my music and allowing me to have input on his lyrics. And I could really produce him to make the best records.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, testament to him to being open to taking my feedback, and testament to me to being able to take his input. Like, I want this beat to sound like this. I think that being humble, he's a little bit older. He's not a lot older than me, but just a little bit. And the maturity that he had helped in terms of being able to do that and make these records.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the main things that come to mind about the partnership in terms of making great music.
I think he's the world's most underrated rapper.
Yeah, yeah. Very creativity.
For sure.
It was always he has a real bubbly, like, outgoing personality. We always had fun together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, it was like a party whenever we were in the studio, and that energy translated into the records. it meant that we could make a lot of records together. You know, some other. He's like a friend. He is a friend. He's like family. And a lot of other artists that I work with, it was not so collaborative. You know, I think it's the relationships.
Sure.
Building. Yeah. Like having a real friendship, a real relationship, as opposed to it just being, oh, I'm going to come over and buy these beats. It's going to be a transaction. Nah, I'm going to come over. I'm going to kick it at the house. We're going to cook. We're going to, you know, play dominoes and, you know, what it's like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I think one thing about 40, one of the reasons why he's had such longevity is that he continues to keep in contact with what's going on with the streets and with the culture. For sure. And he, even though he's, you know, a multimillionaire, he hasn't lost that connection where a lot mm-hmm. of rappers, once they make it to a certain level, mm-hmm. they don't know what's relevant with a certain age group anymore. And so they start to rap from their experiences now,
right,
which don't necessarily connect with the people who are listening to their songs.
That's right.
40 makes it a point to stay connected.
Yeah, and I would say, in a sense, I was maybe the first wave of that. Like, his first stuff was like with Studio Tone,
right,
and those guys are probably the same age as 40.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the next wave was mm-hmm. the stuff that we did together and the stuff he did with Rick Rock.
Mm-hmm.
We're just a little bit younger than him,
mm-hmm.
which helped him, you know, stay on the cutting mm-hmm. edge mm-hmm. and helped us, you know, be connected with somebody that was established.
He got my wife drunk on Carlo Rossi at your wedding.
There it is.
That's hilarious.
He had his own jug.
Yeah, we were at the table, him and his wife and Big John. Mm. And Felly fell, and he kept pulling up that jug. My wife was all in on it.
Man, good times.
Yeah,
good times. That was the secret to the whole shit, was the Carlos Rossi, because we always had the Carlos Rossi in the studio.
I tried to tell.
Now he got his own shit.
I know. Now it's Earl Stevens Select.
I tried to tell. I was doing some work with Carlos Rossi a few years ago, and I was like,
y'all owe
it. I was like, we need to go do a deal with E-40. And they were like, no, that's not our lane. I'm like, yes, it is.
Yeah.
You think it's not.
Yeah.
But you don't know what's happening out there. Right. Like, that's your lane.
Right. They missed an opportunity with that.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, now he's doing it.
Yeah, he could take that lane on his own.
That's crazy. Yo, that was Bosco on Rebel Radio. That's the end of part one. Make sure you come back next week for part two and hear what he's got cooking next. Really exciting tech startup project. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but you're going to want to hear it. In the meantime, leave us a comment, a review on iTunes. Hit us on Twitter, Facebook, wherever else you want. YouTube. We got a YouTube channel with videos from a lot of our interviews. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.